And he spent a whole career then in opposition to the Republic, a Republic then which was a centralizing force. Marat then standing for a different kind of hierarchy, an older French which would have recognized, even as it did hierarchically, on a kind of familial model perhaps, would have recognized the diversity of its different units. And so they had a very amicable discussion. Marat, after all, Mistral himself, worried about the centralizing tendencies, worrying about Provençal identity. And at one point, in fact, Mistral even says to Marat, you know what I heard? I heard, in fact, that there was a Chinese porter who, in fact, saw a sailor in China, and the sailor reported back to me, in fact, that when the sailor said he was from Martigues, and replied from Martigues, which was Marat's hometown, then, in fact, the Chinese man said, aha, and spoke to him in Provençal and not in French, saying, aha, you're from Martigues. And so, in other words, that it had been Provençal sailors who had gone abroad and brought the identity of France, in fact, to the Chinese. And so they had a sort of very amiable discussion in that way. So then I think you've got a problem of what kind of identity is going on at this time, what it means to have double identities, what it means to have Occitan identity. When I've talked to people who speak Occitan at home, one of the things they point out, and it would certainly fit in with what Isaac was saying about the French, is that in that there are no standard, there's no standard pronunciation, no standard spelling for many standard texts or songs in Occitan. If you go to the Rouergue, the Aveyron department, you find one kind of spelling and pronunciation. If you go to the Lot, if you go to Auvergne, if you go to Provence, you find different ones. They're happy about this. This is democratic. If Isaac might say that in these cases, Britannia waives the rules, I think one can say, in fact, that the French also brilliant to indeed waive the rules to have Occitan as a kind of democratic language. So nations then are something more than, you know, the plebiscite of every day, as Renan said, but I think we've got to say that a nation is more than just what one will fight for. That nationality is more than that, and indeed the question of double identity imposes itself, as the French would say, on the question. I sat there and watched these people. The man was a laborer, his wife was a housewife, son was a student, trying to translate for me into French an Occitan love poem. And one line they debated all evening. Just what was the proper French way to express the sentiments therein? And I think then there is certainly a feeling in anyone who studies nationalism and nationality that even today in a culture which is still a subculture, the centralizing French were able to impose the general word patois on all kinds of variations, including full languages like Occitan, Provençal, even Breton would be a patois, would be a sort of inferior local dialect. Nevertheless, we see that there is something lost there, and there is a different way of imagining the sentiments of that community that perhaps is being lost, and it certainly is worth trying to understand. So those are my questions, anyway, for the
Okay, thanks very much. Pastor Anderson, would you like to respond to the talks?
Well, I just want to say just two quick things, because I think people should have a chance to participate here. First of all, I think that it's important when you're thinking about what Isaac and Professor Kramnik and Professor Weiss have said, it's important to remember that the real struggle is not really over what people speak, it's over what they read. That is, the standardization of language, the imposition of King's English, isn't done actually as a mass political phenomenon through speech acts, but it's done through the market of publishing, of writing. That is, the standard spelling, standard dictionaries, all those things that impose a reading French or reading English, and the pushing down of Patois, Breton, Provençal, Scots, and so forth into an unprinted language. So the political pivot on all of this, I think, is writing or printing rather than speech. And it's, after all, print in the early days through the real market, that is, the development of a reading public, reading a single standardized form of the language, which may differ markedly from what they speak, but they still recognize it as the language they ought to read in, comes through the market first. It's much later, with the development of school systems, primers, textbooks, and so forth, that the state actually moves in a very heavy way and to reinforce what the market has already begun to determine. The only other thing I want to suggest is a comment on Walter's discussion of Shakespeare. One of the very odd things about Shakespeare is he's always, people come up to you and say, well, what about Shakespeare after all?
What about Shakespeare?
And there's something very weird about him. I'd just like to say two quick things about why I think the history plays are so bizarre in the context of the time and the context of Shakespeare's work. If you think about the places where Shakespeare puts his characters in all his plays, I just made it in the back of top of my head, think about the sites of the plays. You can think about Norway, Dalmatia, Greece, Rome, Denmark, France, Spain, Egypt, Turkey, Troy, i.e. Italy, England, Scotland, Venice, no Ireland, I'm afraid. But this is quite astonishing. I mean, I can't think of a single other writer in Europe who is so free with his settings. And the interesting thing about that is that everybody speaks exactly the same way, no matter what the setting is. So Troilus and Cressida speak virtually the same way as the sort of upper classes, if you like, in the in later periods. There's no attempt to fabricate, as it were, in any way a kind of distinctly Roman or Greek or Egyptian or Italian speech style. So these are all, in a way, Englishmen, wherever they happen to be, or at least English speakers. And this lack of boundariness, that is, he doesn't feel any discomfort about this. I mean, later playwrights solved the problem by having all that place take place, essentially, in their own countries. Shakespeare's, I think, unique in the sort of spread of sites, and I think this suggests a kind of pre-national conception of things. The other thing that's very remarkable is if you look at the way that Shakespeare treats the kings that he looks at, and that is that, this is the other side of the argument, which is that it's striking that the series of historical plays begins with Richard II. Richard II is the first reign in which English, as we know it, is the state language. Before that, it's been Latin and it's been Norman, French, and so forth. So it's rather interesting that the first of the real series of plays that goes in sequence starts with the first English, if you like, speaking king. But the other side of this is what is left out, and that is that if you remember that Henry VI, the father of the non-French-speaking Henry V, Henry VI was for 20 years king of France, northern France, and in fact occupied, his forces occupied Paris for a generation. That is almost completely blocked out of Shakespeare's later consciousness. There's no sense that our kings should really be kings of France. That is, there's no irredentist feeling about any of Shakespeare's plays, as if there's been a kind of suppression of that pre, if you like, proto-English monarchy, where it's hard to say which side of the channel, in a way, the monarchy of England is really based. So I do think there's a curious ambiguity about Shakespeare, which is very interesting from a political point of view.
I suggest that we have questions and answers for about 15 minutes, and then we move straight to refreshments. Want to give that reassurance so the attrition rate can be less than what we're here.
A question for Walter, since he's framed by two political scientists.
Historians.
Political scientists, Professor Perriman, of course, you were a very crude stratification analysis. But I want to preface it just by kind of giving my language what I think Ben is doing. I mean, Ben is doing in English language what Otto Bauer did in German language. That it is the closest thing to anthropomorphic theory of matter, which, given from where Ben comes, I think, is utterly understandable. What is different about it is the element of time. None of those preconceptions exist in that debate. And that, I think, is an insight which came from literature. So I think, in that sense, the book really does build. There is a tradition in Europe of analyzing it in these categories. I mean, there are numerous histories of journalism in the newspaper written from that perspective, even with Ben King. But there's something very original and different about it. And that comes from literary analysis. Now, you concluded your remark to all of us saying, well, what is the function of the theater? Then you gave a 30-second crude instrumentalist version of Marxism, and that's what that's silly. But he never gave us the answer to what the function was. As I listened to the three of you since John Lodge raised questions, what struck me about it is that the content of nationalism didn't really matter, like you said. That is, Ben uses the form of nationalism, I mean the form of expression as a way of thinking about nationalism. You in your own words, and we had reason to argue about earlier this week, using form as a category. I think there's something in the liberal tradition of writing about nationalism which takes the content of a nationalism as something worth thinking about. I'm thinking of a book which I read about, unsurprisingly, as a songbook, a concept analysis, and they counted up what did these young Germans, what did they sing about? Well, two-thirds of the time they sang about death. They should have told you something, if you had been perceptive, as Harold Basso was in the 1930s, they should have told you something about the character of nationalism. I mean, here was a country living out the collective destiny. I'm baffled that you, coming from the literary side rather than the modified social science side, don't come very heavily down on the content of it. And that is something which we have to understand and study. And for that, the tools of literary criticism, maybe not the latest fact, but literary criticism nonetheless, are much better equipped than the social science.
Well, I mean, in a certain way, I can't answer the question because it calls for a kind of global response. I mean, as for questions of the function of the theater, I wasn't trying to make an argument about the function of the theater at that time. I was trying to ask, answer a very narrow question, and hence the crudeness of the formulation, whether one of the functions of the theater was to promote national consciousness based on a fairly restricted sample of it. The overall function of the theater, I think I do have some opinions about, but they're fairly off this topic. And as the question of form and content, I think I'm probably a product of trends in literary criticism in the last 20 or 30 years. And since, as you know, but maybe other people don't know, I write out of a Marxist tradition of criticism, one of the big problems for Marxist criticism has always been that it seemed to leap at content. Look at that, there's an aristocrat. There's a worker, we're on the side of the worker, that sort of stuff. I'm making it even cruder than it actually is, but you can see the obvious danger of that. And so I think the best recent Marxist theory and Marxist criticism has tried to take seriously the really the main line of literary theory and aesthetic theory in the last 200 years, which has been formalist, and has tried to appropriate that and beat it on its own turf. And that's a sociological explanation of why that comes up. But I think I'm accurately assessing the historical forms of it. And I'm not opposed to content analysis. I mean, there may be some strategic reasons in given cases why one would be better than the other. And you may be right in this case that I missed the strategically useful emphasis on content. But that sort of explains why I did what I did.
Um,
I can just say one or two things. It seems to me that the distinction, the basic distinction you were drawing, would be mappable onto the distinction between a sacred use of language and a non-sacred use of language. And while you may be right that Richard III has the least sacred use of language of all the history plays, even though it was written before some of the others, that may have something to do with the special fact of the protagonist as villain, which is unique in Shakespeare's history plays. But I would say in general that it's easier to see in Shakespeare's later history plays a less sacred use of language. And the second tetralogy, which has a much more coherent sense of political processes, is much more secular in its orientation, and it seems to move out of, you know, move out of the sacred into the secular. That's about all I could do right now.
I think I direct my question to Professor Anderson and or John Morrison. Is it, are there other people besides Rupert Brooke who put forth this idea that, you know, the grave of the soldier in a foreign place becomes then part of the homeland? He's whole thing about this little Sassanian is going to be his grave.
De Gaulle sent a team of dentists to the collective graveyards in Germany trying to, in fact, identify French bodies, even though some of these graveyards, in fact, had been, you know, were just the people from a battle and were sort of put all together in a startling difficulty. And you had to take the dental records to find the French to have them returned to French soil. So I guess he thought there was some significance in doing that and being in the geographical boundary of France.
I think that, yeah, I mean, talking, asking a literary question or asking a political question. Well, it's very, I mean, it's clear that sort of, that kind of poetry is part of the sort of culture of Edwardian imperialism. That is, you know, if the British die in Mandalay or they die in wherever it is, Khartoum, I mean, in a way, the fact that they died there shows that is where the empire, I mean, that's where Englishmen die is where the empire is. That's very much part of this, of that generation of writing. It seems to me that, I'm just thinking of churches in the southern part of Ireland where I grew up. It was very striking that if you go into these churches, small churches in the area, and remember that a lot of the mercenaries of the empire were recruited in southern Ireland, it was quite interesting to go along these Protestant walls of the churches, and you'll see all these things. Mr. X, so-and-so, died fighting gallantly against the Zulus in wherever it is, and the next one over will be died fighting gallantly against the Chinese somewhere else. It's an extraordinary imperial museum in a way, all of which is linked by death. There's nothing except death that tie all these different places together, but you can see the empire actually quite clearly in the church through the skeletons, as it were.
One last question.
It's
a question for Professor Anderson.
Yeah. I wonder if there isn't a contradiction between one of the things you said in your preamble and one of your conclusions. When you were explaining why you were interested in the subject, why it's important, and why you wrote two books in common, one of the things you said is that we've been watching this terribly rapid and strong breakdown of internationalism on the part of culture, like China, and the European Union, and it's a revival of various kinds of nationalism and communist centers. Then in your conclusion, you said that you drew some kind of parallel between printing, which I don't want to ask about, and the rise of capitalism and nationalism. Well, now you say yourself that there is this survival in post-capitalistic society. You had a very rapid recrudescence survival of nationalism. Wouldn't that cast some doubt on your this analogous parallel you're drawing as a causal?
Well, the argument that I make in the book, which is rather long and complicated one, is that if capitalism and print and vernaculars explain the origins of nationalism, but one of the beauties of print, or the uglinesses of print, is that it turns all experience into something that can be imagined and modeled. And so, I mean, the central chapters of the book are about what the American nationalisms of the late 18th century, how they helped to model the vernacular nationalisms of Europe in the middle of the 19th century. how the reaction to vernacular nationalism in Central Europe produced imperial nationalism in the end of the century, and imperial nationalism in turn is modeled by revolutionary nationalism in the early part of the 20th century, so that in a way each learns sometimes sinister lessons from the past. And the key thing here is that in the last phase of nationalism, which I think of as the sort of third world nationalism, revolutionary nationalism, there's always a double element. That is, there's both the residues of popular republican nationalism, vernacular nationalism, and imperial, well, not imperial, but state or dynastic nationalism. And you can see this very clearly in the combination whereby Brezhnev gets up and says, we are the most socialist country in the world, whatever it is. And by God, Ivan the Terrible, you know, was right when he said we ought to have all of Central Asia. In fact, it doesn't strike me as hard at all. Seems to me to show you that, I mean, that's what's, it seems to me that print is really quite crucial for this, because it's a kind of the archive of human memory, which allows for experiment and variation on models.
Okay, I think it's pretty much it there. Professor Anderson.